In the retail market right now, there are winners and losers. What side you're on is dependent on how you react to these challenges. Welcome to Tell Me Something Good About Retail, the podcast of The Retail Doctor. I'm your host, Bob Phibbs. Have you ever wondered about all the bad news about retail? Is there really anything that small and large retailers can do about the supposed retail apocalypse? Well, we're going to find out on today's episode with Neil Saunders. Welcome, Managing Director and Retail Analyst at Global Data, Neil Saunders.
Thank you, Bob. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, who are you and what do you have to do with retail?
Well, in my current role, I'm Managing Director and Retail Analyst at Global Data. And what I really do in that role is advise our clients, which are retailers, CPG firms, and others, on the retail landscape, what's going on, what's happening with customers, helping them with their business strategy. So it's great because you get to have a very broad view of the industry and trends, rather like you do yourself, and you touch on a lot of different clients and different situations.
Yeah. And so why retail? I hear that accent. I think I saw you're from Surrey, England, or you started in Surrey, or?
Oh, well, I started really my career in London in the UK. And I worked in retail in the UK. I worked for the John Lewis Partnership. It was my first job after I left university. And that's really, in a way, what sparked my interest in the sector. I loved working for a retailer, but I found that I actually quite liked the analytical side, looking at the data, looking at the dynamics and trends, and then trying to fashion those into business strategy. So after John Lewis, I left and joined a retail consultancy called Verdict, which was a very UK-focused retail consultancy. And over time, I developed my role there into much more of a consulting type position. And then I decided eventually, after a while, that I'd like to move to the US because it was a different market, different trends, different dynamics, some similarities. I just wanted to have a change. So I ended up here in the US.
Well, so go back to that time when you're with John Lewis. How do you think retail has changed since then, or how it's stayed the same? Since you're the analytics guy, obviously you have looked at so many different retailers, and John Lewis is a strong brand, right? I mean, they're one of the UK's best.
Yeah, they're a very good brand. And I think one of the reasons they're a good brand is because they've constantly moved forward. And I think that is one of the things that's changed since when I started. When I started, there was a lot of shifting going on in retail, but it was comparatively slow. You could almost take your time to digest and understand before reacting. I think nowadays, everything moves with great speed. There's immediacy in retail. You need to look, understand, digest trends very quickly, and then act on them very quickly because customers have become more demanding. I think the landscape is much faster. There are more competitors. Everyone's much nimbler than they used to be. And you just need to move at great pace, but with also great accuracy. And the two things are very difficult to balance. So
that's funny you say that, because I think there's this fear of missing out. Oh, we need beacons. Oh, wait a minute. We need to be on Foursquare. Oh, wait a minute. It's all about Facebook. Oh, wait a minute. We got to have a WhatsApp. And our discussion today, I think, would be great to frame it in the terms of there are winners and losers. And while I appreciate a lot of winners are throwing a lot at the wall, I think when I look at a Target who has taken a lot of initiatives, but it seems like they are more strategic than some of the losers. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, I would. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that there are so many distractions in retail, and it's very easy to chase after the latest fad. It's very easy to say, oh, this is the next big thing. Let's go and invest in this. But I think really what good retailers do and what differentiates those winners from the losers is the good ones always tie whatever they're doing back to their reason for existing. So they look at their core proposition. They look at who the customers are. They look at the landscape and the competitors and they say, okay, what does this mean for us? And I think that leads them to really focus investment like Target has done, as you note. And I think that it also enables them to say no to things. So they can say, actually, you know what? beacons are not for us. It doesn't do much for us. There's very little point in it for our customer base. Or they comparatively say, as Target did, actually, you know what? Stores are vital. And I remember, and you'll remember as well, when Target first announced it was refurbishing stores, Wall Street was very shocked by this. They were, you know, what are they doing investing money in stores? This is the channel of the past. And of course, Target knew that that wasn't the case, but they had the confidence to do it because they understood the customers and the landscape, and they therefore made the proper investments. And as we know now, it's paying dividends.
Huge dividends, just like Walmart with their 200 training centers. And a lot of things they're looking at to shake off you're the retailer of last resort that people want to work with. You know, the thing that I'm noticing, and you know, we are so frequently quoted together in different publications. I, yes. I feel like I'm talking to this spiritual brother from another mother type of thing, because we do see the world as, you know, I think retail is suddenly becoming this place that a whole new group of people are saying KPIs don't matter. It doesn't matter if we open a store and no one comes. It's about, you know, presenting this experience. And I think you and I both come back to, well, but does it sell? Does it really add an ROI? Does it really move the needle? Because we can certainly come up with many pretty stores and pretty stories, but it comes down to execution. I think we share that, correct?
I would agree, yeah. I mean, I think it comes back to really understanding what the role of retail is. And I think retail is a difficult business to get right. But I think conceptually, it's not very complicated. You need to sell things, and you put things out, you lay out your stall, and you hope that people will come and buy those products from you. And you have to make sure you obviously sell them at a profit. And I think you're right. I think what a lot of people sometimes do is they forget that is the whole reason for being a retailer. And they get very excited about, oh, we're doing this, collection only type store, or a pop-up store. And you look at it and you think, oh, it's interesting and it's good. But then you say to them, well, did you make money from it? Or did it drive something else in your business? And they sort of look at you a bit clueless, as if, you know, that wasn't really the point of the exercise. But of course, that is the point of a retail business, and you sort of need to remember that. And I think that gets lost sometimes when we have all these technologies and other fancy things.
Otherwise, the emperor has no clothes, and you're just calling it out and saying, well, but, you know, is this a distraction? I think, again, I think we come back to that with winners and losers, that to me, I think an awful lot of losers have lost this human connection. You know, I always say that people buy more when they feel they matter. And you show that in a number of ways. But to me, it's being more human in an increasingly technological world. I think there's another segment that says it doesn't matter. Technology is going to solve everything. The more we make a store like a website, and the more people can get in and get out, the better. And so we're just going to discount the merchandise and hope something happens. And I think, again, I go back to Walmart. You know, everybody scratched their heads 2 years ago. Why is Walmart opening training centers? But really what they did was they said, we got to change this culture. And is that something you're seeing with your clients, that that's where they're going, or are they discounting that and moving more to technology? What would you say?
Well, I think it varies very much. I think that the good ones are definitely changing the culture. I think the good retailers recognize the importance of humans in the whole process, and they're looking at automation, but they're often looking at automation, I suppose, in areas that are, you know, very little added value. A bit like Walmart, you know, cleaning floor robots. I mean, cleaning the floor is important, but it's a job a robot can do. But Walmart is interesting because I think the focus is always about taking out the mundane tasks so that it frees up more time for staff to do the added value things. And I think that's what the good retailers are focusing on. I think the bad retailers are the ones that really think that automation is the key to everything. They can strip out as many labor costs as possible, And they forget that humans play a very important part in that interaction. Because I think that, as you noted, when customers go into the store, they want to be recognized, they want to be seen. And even very simple interactions with staff are a part of what makes physical retailing attractive. You do go into the store to buy something or to browse, obviously, but the little interactions that you have along the way can make your day better. And that sounds kind of corny, but actually it is a very important thing. And I think that good retailers understand that, and they put in the training and the empowerment for staff so that that can be delivered. And that does make all the difference. Why would you keep going back to a store where you're not seen and recognized, right, and you're not made to feel good? There's not much point in it.
To me, that's the hardest thing, is how do I create it and deliver a branded shopping experience? I think it's very difficult. And to your point, yes, you can use AI and learn a lot about customers. And, you know, I think we're a far cry, as I talked to a Disney exec a few years ago, and they said, you know, when you walk into our store, we absolutely can know that your daughter is there. We can know her name. You're at Disney World. We haven't solved the creep factor.
Yes.
He said, I just don't see how we're going to do that in the foreseeable future.
Yes.
You know, that promise that, yes, we do know all of that. And I don't know if you saw Hacked on Netflix. It's the new...
I did.
Oh my gosh, we created 5,000 data points and now we can predict everything. And, you know, that's pretty scary. But I just wonder, where is that tipping point of what personal service and creepy is? Because it really isn't personal. Personal is if I know you, Neil, I saw you by the golf clubs, we talked about it, you came back in, we have a conversation, versus an email I get from you. So where can personalization and AI take us, do you think, in retail without being that creep factor?
Well, I think it's helpful, but you're absolutely right. It has to be used in an appropriate way, because, you know, there are certain things that you don't mind retailers knowing about you, especially if you've told them in a survey or you've bought something previously. It's kind of obvious the retailer is going to know that. I think when you start putting other data points on it and you start using algorithms to make assumptions and you start developing personality types, I think that one of two things happen. Either you get it completely wrong, you alienate your customer, which still often happens, or you actually get it completely right, and then you creep out your customer because the customer's like, how do they know that about me? How have they figured this one out? And I think that then becomes quite dangerous because you can damage the relationship as well. So there is a very fine balance. But, you know, when it comes to things like being in store, there's nothing wrong with talking to people and finding things out that way. Oh, you know, even a simple, you know, what are you looking for? Mm. And then launching into a conversation to learn things about people. I think that is the way in stores that you develop that good customer service. I think with the data, you use the data, I think, to help people. I think that's where it's more appropriate. So for example, if you had bought a particular, I don't know, a sink in Home Depot previously, and you bought it online, and then you go into store because you want a faucet, and you say to them, you know, I need a faucet for my sink, and which ones fit. I think the store staff then being able to look at what you've bought and say, oh yeah, you know, you've got this sink, these are the options you have. That's where it's really useful, because it's appropriate, it's sensible, it's adding value. I think that's where the kind of balance is right, rather than using it in a creepy way to say, oh, you know, you're this type of person, you should buy this, that, or the other. That, I think, is less appropriate.
We'll explore more in just a bit, but first, a quick word about Field Agent, our sponsor this season. Field Agent is an on-demand platform that furnishes businesses with in-store information, shopper insights, and services to drive product sales, all through the Field Agent mobile app, featuring a panel of over 1.5 million shoppers. In a matter of hours, you can get photos and data from stores everywhere. If you need in-store visibility and you need it fast, Field Agent is the solution for you. Visit www.fieldagent.net/retaildoctor for exclusive content. Now let's get back to it.
What do you think some of the challenges are with retail between winners and losers? And if you were to just knock out three off the top of your head.
I think the I think the biggest challenge is differentiation. I think there's so much choice in the market now. There are so many retailers all doing different things, some of them good, some of them not so good. The question that every retailer should be asking is, how do you stand out? How is what you are providing is different? And I think when you look at the failures and the retailers that are not doing well, Sears obviously being one, JCPenney falling into that category, they don't have an answer to that. There's nothing that feels special or unique about them. And it's very easy for customers to overlook them and say, you know what, I'm not going to visit that store or that website. So I think differentiation is absolutely key. I think one of the things we touched on previously is managing investment. I think there are so many demands on capital investment these days that you have to say, right, we're going to do three things and we're going to do them really well and invest in them, not have this scattergun approach of chasing one thing, then moving to the next, switching to the next, and actually never really doing anything properly. I think that's a very big challenge. And I'd say the third thing is actually just keeping up with and understanding customers. As I mentioned, everything moves so fast and you really need to stay on top of things. And one of the things that I would mention in relation to that is using staff. Your staff on the shop floor, your colleagues, your associates, they are your eyes and ears. And it's all very good gathering all these data points and they're really useful. But sometimes managers just going into stores, senior executives going into store, talking to these people, what are you finding? What are the changes? What are the problem areas? That is one of the things I think that sometimes in this world of big data gets lost. It's just going back to basics, going to the shop floor and understanding.
I think that's a great point. I know, the infamous Ron Johnson debacle at Penny's was, we'll get rid of everybody who's been with the brand for a while and we'll start fresh. Well, most people would have given their eye teeth to know that. Like, you've been here 20 years, you've seen things come and go. To your point, if I have a good experience with my employees, like a Lululemon or a Container Store, or there are several, then they probably will bubble up these ideas and be willing. What I tend to see, I was at I wouldn't say a big box, but one step down, kind of a boutique-y brand, and the people came in and they all had their clipboards and it was all about, oh, these three towels should all be arranged this way, and you need to ship these out. And there was no question about what's selling or what are you hearing or, you know, no valuing your own employees. And I just always think, well, yes, that's a miss, but I also think, so then aren't you really showing what you think of these people? You're really just one step up from a robot. And if that's the case, why would I go out of my way to go to your store when 80% of the merchandise you carry, yeah, it might have a private label on it, but it's still let's say a white dish towel. It's still the same as I could get most anywhere else. We're not going to go out of our way for that anymore, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think you really need to look at what you're delivering and make sure that it is interesting and that it is very appropriate for customers. And I think, you know, there's something of a lost art in that. I think some of the old school merchants in retail, they had very good flair and understanding for what the customer wanted. And they were able to innovate because they always tied back the innovations to demand, whether it be buying a new product, doing something differently in store. And I think, you know, and we both consult, but I think there's a very big difference between what I call practical consulting, which I think is the type of consulting we do.
That's what we do
in retail. We come from the shop floor. We come from the background of retail. And what I call accountancy type consulting, which I'm very much against, which is where people come in with the clipboards and they say, make these cuts. And I remember, I mean, you'll remember it too, a little while ago, the fascinating story of Market Basket, the New England grocery chain, where, you know, it had always been run along the lines of having slightly lower margins because they delivered great prices. That was a proposition and the promise to customers. Very loyal staff, because the CEO, Arthur Demoulas, would go into the store, talk to everyone, every store lunch he was there. And then there was a sort of, you know, corporate shenanigans and other people became in charge and they got management consultants in. And of course, the first thing they said is raise your prices because your margins are too low. And of course, they did that. And customers just deserted the store in droves because they didn't understand fundamentally why the customers shop there, the differentiation in the market, how it worked. And Arthur Demoulas came back and turned it round. And he said in an interview, you know, one of the things that they never got was you know, we charge lower prices and we pay higher salaries and give more benefits because the two things actually work hand in hand. Yes, we get lower margins and lower profits from the product, but because we treat the staff very well, they're actually so much more productive. They don't leave, so they don't need training. They invest their own time in the stores. And because we're more productive, that's how the business model works. And of course, the consultants didn't get that because they didn't understand the business. And I think that's a really interesting case study in someone who is a merchant and a proper retailer and has a proper understanding of the whole facets of the business. And other people that just come in and look at the spreadsheets and the numbers. And you can't run a retail business by just looking at the numbers. It doesn't work.
Totally agree with that. I think of Trader Joe's also here in the States that has a loyal following. And it's interesting, they're both in grocery. Yes. Costco too. Costco has certainly a higher threshold for that. And I think that challenge of execution, it is about being brilliant on the basics. And, which also brings me, with free-flowing conversation we're having today, with the role of VCs and so many retailers going out. You know, was it really that Toys R Us was so bad off, or was it because they were ladled with debt? Is it because JCPenney is so bad off or ladled with debt? I tend to think that once you go the VC route, you probably are already dead. You didn't figure out your customer, and you figured, well, we'll just get some money in, or maybe they took you over in a hostile takeover, but you probably don't have the steering room to make a difference. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. I'd completely agree with that. I think VCs, as you say, sometimes they have a role. They take on businesses that otherwise wouldn't survive. But I think there is a real point to be made that where a VC treats a business as an ATM machine just to get money out of and ladens it up with debt, that retailer has very little chance of survival. And you see these highly leveraged, very debt-ridden traders like Toys R Us or even J. Crew now, which has a colossal amount. I mean, how they've got that much debt is—it's completely it's not baffling. You know how it's been done, but it is an enormous. It's an incredible
Neiman Marcus
amount of debt.
Or
Neiman
billion.
Marcus.
Tell me, how do we get there? I mean,
exactly. These numbers are staggering.
Get just $1 million in debt? Could I do that? What the hell? And I'll still be in business, and I'll tell everything's fine. But I want to be like $5 million in debt.
Yeah, it's if you take on debt and you're using it to invest and to grow the business, I think that's fine. But when you're just taking basically money out, I think you leave a retailer with no room for maneuver at all. And I going back to my first job at John Lewis. John Lewis is a partnership, so basically it's a workers' cooperative. It's very commercially focused. It says profit is part of the objective. But one of the things that I always take away from that is that John Lewis would rather make a little bit less money by investing and doing things properly and for the longer term than take the short-term gain of increasing profitability, whether it be by taking on lots of debt to give out in bonuses or whether it be by, cutting something here or there. And I think that that's an absolutely key focus for retailers today. They have to be long-term focused. You cannot be about the short-term gains. And it's a real problem for some.
Yes,
and if you look at Amazon. I mean, Amazon is very long-term focused. I mean, Amazon is on the next 20 years down the line and it's investing and it doesn't mind not making so much of a profit. And it shows in the results.
But they also haven't figured out brick and mortar. So
no, they haven't.
Kind of interesting. I was reading how they've actually lost. Whole Foods is losing market share in many markets. And even though they theoretically lowered the price, it's not special, to your point. How are you differentiating? Now you're part of Amazon, and now they're changing the private label to show Amazon as well. And what does that feel like then when you're shopping with them? It's a multifaceted discussion, and I probably could continue. I do have to, though, with your background, I do have to ask, so where are we going with Brexit? What's retail going to look like in London? This uncertainty has been over them for 2 years. So I just wonder, how do you plan and where do they go either way with the October Halloween deadline? Maybe not movable. Who knows?
Well, I think this you put your finger on it with the word that you mentioned. It's uncertainty. I think no one really still knows exactly what's going to happen. We have a bit more certainty, sure, that we're supposedly leaving on the 31st of October, but I think that it's still up in the air to a certain extent. And I think it makes it very difficult for retailers and others to prepare, because you don't want to make massive investments for something that's perhaps not going to come off. And of course, the other problem is that, you know, with the potential disruption to supply chains, it comes at the worst possible time, because everyone's gearing up for the holidays. The warehouses are absolutely crammed full of Christmas inventory, so there's very little slack in the system. So, you know, from the retailer's point of view, it really is very, very challenging to plan. From the consumer's point of view, I think that the uncertainty is what makes people hesitant about spending. And that, of course, is not great in the run-up to the holidays. So in some ways, we need to have a very firm conclusion on it one way or the other, so that retailers basically can just get on with the business of retailing rather than being distracted by everything else that's going on around them.
And I think it would be the same thing in the States with tariffs. Everyone is like, well, they're going to be kicked down the hole. You know, it's not going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. Clearly, something's going to happen. And to your point again, it couldn't happen at the worst time.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and you know, we've talked a lot in this discussion about all of the issues with retailing that are internal to retailing, the digital things, the investment, all of those things. The last thing you want, arguably, as a trader, is to have these external factors like tariff or Brexit on top of it. But unfortunately, they're there and they have to be dealt with.
Well, that's exactly it. Well, I want to ask you two more questions and then we'll be done. So, what would you tell a friend? They take you out to a local coffee house. They say, Neil, I want to open my own brick and mortar retail store. What would you tell them?
I would say, first of all, you know, what are you doing that is different, and why are you passionate about it? And I think if you can answer those two questions, you have a good case for opening a business. And then you need to work backward to find out how you make that business work financially. It's a bit like Simon Sinek says, start with the why. Right. Start with why you're doing something, why you're different. I think a lot of people say, I'd like to get into retail. I'd like to open a coffee shop. I'd like to open a store. And I think that's very noble and it's a great ambition, but you can't start with that. You have to start with that intersection of what are you bringing to the market that's unique and is needed, and why does it make you passionate while you get up in the morning and work really hard on this? And if you start with those questions and then work back as to how you're going to make the business work, I think it has a much better chance of success than just saying, hey, I'd like to open a store because it's kind of a cool thing and I feel like it's something I'd enjoy.
No, that's exactly it. And let's face it, you know, people say they want to open a bar or a bed and breakfast. I'm always like, so you want to be at a bar at 2 a.m. every morning? Oh, no, I'll just hire someone. Oh, really? Or you want to hire a bed and breakfast? Oh, it'll be cool. You know, they'll be in our house. It'll be easy. It's like, have you ever thought of having people in your house 24 hours a day? Well, not really. And then you say, so if you did that, what are the systems that have to be in place for you to make money? Because anyone can open a store, right? This field of dreams that, you know, to your point, you have a unique need for it. Nobody needs anything you're going to open a new store for. I don't care. It's branded with a little cat with a dog toy. It doesn't matter. It's ultimately, do you have enough passion to see it through? Because a lot of digital brands thought the way forward was going to be just digital. That's where all the money was. And now they're opening brick and mortar stores. Like, well, I guess that's kind of limited. I think that's certainly a great way to think of it. I like that idea with the passion and really thinking about that. And so two things, tell me something good about retail.
I think that it is one of the most interesting sectors in industry because I think that it moves with great speed. Everything is visible. You can see customers. You can talk to customers. It's tangible. You can touch it. And I think you can enact change and you can see the results of that change very quickly. So, you know, if you change your product, your store, the way you do business online, I think you can see the reaction to that. So I think it's a wonderful arena in which to experiment and to innovate. just because it is so accessible and it's all around us. And I think that makes it really, really exciting in a way that personally I don't find a lot of other industries like healthcare or chemical production or things like that. They're great industries, but they don't have that same immediacy and sort of tangibility.
That's a great point, because your whole operation can change with the next person walking in the door.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's kind of amazing. And how can they find out more about you and Global Data other than reaching you in like every magazine and newspaper in the country? Because they always come to you for your analytical chops, which are usually great.
Usually alongside you as well as you mentioned. I think if you want to know more about me, then I'm on Twitter. My handle is Neil Retail, all one word. And you can also go to globaldata.com if you want to find more about Global Data.
Excellent. Well, you've been a gentleman joining me here today, and I really appreciate it. And I commend everybody to listen to this man, because not only has he come from brick and mortar, but he has the chops to see what's going on. And you know what? It still comes down to the same thing we both agree on. It's about being brilliant on the basics. Again, thanks so much for joining me, Neil.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, that pretty much does it. And I want to thank my guest, Neil Saunders, and tell you that one of the things that I really took from this was his idea that there are so many distractions in retail, and it's easy to chase after the latest fad, and that ultimately you have to look at who your customers are and the landscape of your competitors and just say, okay, what does this technology or initiative mean for us? On the next episode of Tell Me Something Good About Retail, I'll speak with father and son Jordan and Neil Edwards about how they've started multiple brick and mortar businesses and their tips for success. You won't want to miss it. I'm Bob Phibbs, the Retail Doctor. Thanks for listening.
Tell Me Something Good About Retail is the podcast of the Retail Doctor. Visit RetailDoc.com to learn what makes Bob Phibbs the authority on brick and mortar retail across the world, who works with some of the biggest brands all the way down to the smallest mom and pops. As a listener of the Tell Me Something Good About Retail podcast, you can receive free information and guides when you visit RetailDoc.com and sign up for our exclusive weekly newsletter. For more information, to access the complete archives of past retail goodness, and to see about Bob speaking to your audience, please visit RetailDoc.com.